Welcome back to the Health Longevity Secrets Show with Dr. Robert Lufkin. Today, we're going to hear from the physician with arguably the largest experience worldwide in prescribing rapamycin for longevity. Dr. Green is a board-certified pathologist currently specializing in the treatment of age-related disease. He has an MD from the State University of New York Downstate Medical Center College of Medicine and a residency in anatomic and clinical pathology from Winthrop University Hospital. Now, rapamycin, also known as sirolimus or Rapamune, is an FDA-approved prescription drug with indications for use for the prevention of organ transplant rejection and for the treatment of lymphangioleiomatosis. Any other use is off-label. Rapamycin should only be used under the supervision of a physician. The information in this program is for educational purposes only and is not medical advice. Please also see our disclaimer at the end. Now, enjoy this interview with Dr. Alan Green. Dr. Green, it's a pleasure having you on the show. There's so many things I want to ask you about your practice, but maybe start off just how you became interested in the study of longevity.
Well, about the early sort of like it, but just as I turned 70, it occurred, it seemed to me that I was sort of like having a very rapid decline of my health. And based on the rapid decline, I thought I was going to be dead in a few years. And I mistakenly thought that I was suffering from aging. I didn't know anything about aging at the time. So like most doctors, I had zero knowledge of aging, but I had like confidence that I could look up aging in a medical textbook and find out what I'd like to know about it. So I looked at a medical textbook and I was absolutely amazed to find out it wasn't there. I mean, I was so flabbergasted. I was like looking through all these books, I'm looking at the index, looking at the table of contents. Aging is simply not there. And I'm like blown away by this. So then I decided to sort of like start studying aging on my own. And the first thing I came across was the study that they did in like UK about metformin, and that people taking metformin were living longer than sort of like, you know, non-diabetics, non-metformin. Well, that was amazing that anything like that could happen. So that sort of like got me like interested in that there might be something to this. And eventually I came across like Lagus Chelone. Now, I was just extraordinarily impressed with Lagus Chelone. He was the only person who was like making any sense. And Lagus Chelone just had an extraordinary brilliant conception of the whole thing. So after like studying Lagus Chelone's works for about like 6 months and studying everything he had to say, I decided that I would try his sort of like formula of like rapamycin. He had like suggested taking rapamycin in his like 2006 paper. And all those papers since then. So this is sort of like January 2016. Now, prior to January 16, in the sort of like paper that came out Christmas Eve in 2014 by Jane Manick, like that changed everything, because prior to that paper, it seemed that you couldn't take rapamycin because it had an adverse effect on your immune system. Well, Jane Manick showed that no, that was just a case of how you were taking it. When she gave it to people like once a week or a short period of time, like she showed that she had an improvement in their sort of like acquired immune system. They had a better response to like flu shots. So that changed everything. That meant that if it wasn't having a bad effect on your T cell function or acquired immune system, that made it safe. So I decided to sort of like try it. And by going through Lagus Chelone's like papers, I decided to come up with a dose of say 6 milligrams once a week, because Lagus Chelone was real clear that it should be used intermittently. And Lagus Chelone also had a paper in which he said that they gave a 6 milligram dose to volunteers and it had an effect. So like 6 milligrams seemed like a therapeutic effect. And that seemed like pretty good. So I decided I would just try that. I was trying to have like a high dose because I wasn't too concerned about side effects. I was much more concerned that it simply would not have any effect. I was not really expecting much of an effect. I had very low expectations. So I like started in like January of like 2016, and I'm going along, and by like, you know, like 3 months or so, I am just blown away. I am like unbelievable. I like feel like I'm like 5 or 10 years younger. I am not suffering from any distress whatsoever. Prior to that, I had been suffering from severe, definite like heart failure, like an early stage of heart failure. And then I, from mild exercise, I would get like signs of like heart failure, shortness of breath and other things like that. So now, but now I'm just doing unbelievable. I'm not having any symptoms whatsoever. I like pick up cycling. I'm riding my bike like 1,000 miles a month. I'm like feeling fantastic. I just could not be sort of like feeling in better shape. So I'm continuous going along with that. And I feared, well, this is like the greatest thing ever. I can't believe how great this stuff is. The only problem is if you were in a position, you couldn't get it. So I feared like there wasn't any way to get it. So I feared, well, if this continues working in like really very good like this, after a year, I will like open up a little practice because I'd already been retired for 10 years as a pathologist. And I had no intention of starting a practice. I just decided that I would make this available for a few people who were like studying all this sort of like the literature. They decided they wanted to use rapamycin, but they didn't have any way to get it. And they didn't really know quite how to use it. So I decided I would do that. So I just set up an office in like part of my house. It was like, so it's like zero overhead. And it was just set up to have a practice that I would see like, you know, like 2 patients a month. That was perfectly fine. You know, that was the idea. No overhead, see 2 patients a month, who people who had like made a special, like were especially interested in this and wanted to try it, but they weren't a physician, so they couldn't write a prescription. So this was going on, the first patient in like March of 2017. Everything was going on great. And then like a couple years later, I have an opportunity to have an echocardiogram. I have the echocardiogram and I find out I wasn't suffering from aging at all. I was like totally not suffering from aging. That was like totally not what it was. I had like an extremely rare cardiomyopathy. And that's what I had. And then I realized, wow, then it's like, I realized that's what my mother died from. That's what my grandmother died from. That's how there's no old people on the mother's side of the family. It was like an autosomal dominant cardiomyopathy. And that's what sort of like people like, that's what they had. They initially had both, I had presented with atrial fibrillation in my 50s, but there was no other finding. And both my mother and my grandmother, they had died from like complications of atrial fibrillation. But other people had died from complications, direct heart complications. So it's like real clear that that's what people had. It was like a very rare thing. It was like apical hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, which is like, it's like hypertrophic cardiomyopathy is rare. And this was about 5% of those cases. So it was like, it was like quite remarkable that it responded terrific to rapamycin, which turns out to be most of the hypertrophic cardiomyopathies respond to rapamycin because it doesn't seem to matter too much about what the initial genetic cause is. And they all have, there's a whole big variety of them. They have different genetic causes. But the common sort of like denominator at the end is they have whatever is going on, they wind up with elevated mTOR. So mTOR stands for target of rapamycin. So they have elevated mTOR, and that's what's causing the hypertrophy. That's what's causing the fibrosis. That's what's causing inflammation in the disease process. It was simply a case of complete luck that I sort of like wound up into this, because if I had done the right thing and seen a cardiologist, the cardiologist would have done an echocardiogram and it said, well, you have this cardiomyopathy and come back when you need a heart transplant.
Wow.
There was zero treatment available. So, but by then I was sort of like doing great. And realized that rapamycin worked extraordinarily well in all sorts of things. Curiously, I found there was some other sort of like a patient, a couple of brothers who had a different, extraordinarily rare cardiomyopathy. Lamin A cardiomyopathy. It's like I never even heard of it. They did great on rapamycin. They had been doing like, was like the one person, he was a professor. So he did some independent research and he found out that people were treating a mouse model that was rapamycin. So he wanted to try rapamycin. So he had very good medical treatment, but they weren't giving him, they wouldn't give him rapamycin. So I came, he had an extraordinarily good response and went back to like teaching full time. So him and his brother too did like very, very well on it. So rapamycin turned out to be real, real good for hypertrophic cardiomyopathies.
But
then I had like a very nice like practice and I realized it seemed to work for just about all sorts of things. It seemed to work for mostly all the age-related diseases that were especially associated with increased risk with diabetes. So if you had an age-related disease and people with metabolic syndrome, overweight people, diabetes had an increased risk, rapamycin worked with that. Because all those people, they were all elevated mTOR diseases. I mean, there's going to be like a few other strange sort of like more unusual age-related diseases that don't have any, that if it's an age-related disease and it occurred in thin people, it was less likely that rapamycin would work. But if it occurred in fat people and increased risk, that rapamycin was going to work.
Maybe for our audience, you could just go over some basic fundamentals about how does dialing down mTOR as a nutrient sensing protein, how can it affect all these so many diseases like that?
Well, it affects all the diseases because it looks like all the diseases have a sort of like a common pathway, because rapamycin is only doing one thing. Its only effect is to decrease mTOR. And if you can use it, depending on how you use it, it's decreasing mTOR1 or mTOR2. But it turns out that mTOR is basically at the center of everything that's going on in the cell. So that's a peculiar thing. So mTOR has basically been the command and control of the cell for seems like the last 2 billion years. And how I can trace it back to 2 billion years is because it's in the plant world and it's in the animal world. And they can sort of like trace that sort of like split between the one cell animal that was a common ancestor splitting into, say, like the vegetable world on the yeast side and the animal world and the protozoa side. That was basically 2 billion years ago. So,
isn't it amazing? Yeah, that we can see mTORs as a major signaling protein all the way from yeast to human beings, and turning down mTOR has longevity benefits in every single one of those animals and plants that it.
It seems there's like a couple, but there was like two dramatic different effects. mTOR seems to want to like increase longevity by working on mitochondrial complex 1. And that it seems to like work on there. And that seems to be in common with a lot of pathways. It seems like you can turn down complex 1 with like caloric restriction or like protein restriction or methionine restriction or rapamycin. They all seem to have the same sort of changing the mitochondrial function so that complex 1 is less sloppy with electrons, to sort of like describe it in one sort of way. In other words, if it's like less sloppy with spilling ends with electrons, that slows down, that causes less DNA damage and slows down aging. That seems to be sort of like a common sort of like technique for controlling aging, because when the other sort of like some of the very, very slight top researchers, I think it's like Borja or something like that, like the name of like Spain, he showed that that was what was going on. It's like controlling aging in different species. In other words, having like you had like a bird, which is the same size as a rat, and the rat's living 3 years and the bird's living 30 years. And he was showing it was like basically it was like that mitochondrial function that was doing that, that how they sort of like adjusted the mitochondria would affect, take a dollar, affect the lifespan. So that was one thing that it was like that lysin was doing. But the other thing it was doing is just and turning down like mTOR, aside from this direct mitochondrial effect, was having a very adverse effect on just about everything as far as age-related diseases. For one thing it was doing very directly, it was causing increased inflammation. In other words, it was having a direct effect on what's called the innate immune system. Now, the innate immune system is involved with inflammation and like macrophages. It's not the acquired immune system, but that system and an overreact response of that system seems to be involved in downstream. It's like huge, all these like from like nuclear factor KB to sort of like, you know, all these other factors, all these different factors, which are causing like inflammation and like damaging effects on all sorts of like diseases. It's turning those down. That seems to like, so there seems to be like a host of like the huge different things, and they all seem to get involved in like diseases because it basically started, I would say, about 2010. Now, prior to like, in 2009, that was the first time they showed that rapamycin increased the lifespan of mice. So when it showed increased the lifespan of mice, and it showed that wasn't just decreasing cancer, they, when they evaluated, they could see it was slowing down aging. That was sort of like, that was the general consensus of what it was doing. It was not just decreasing the mice's risk of cancer. It was really slowing down aging because it was affecting, they could see, also they could see all sorts of other things like flies and worms that didn't get cancer. It was increasing their lifespan too. So it was having a real effect on slowing down aging. Well, now all the different like researchers started looking at what mTOR was doing in all the different diseases. Like nobody was interested in rapamycin. They were interested in what's the pathway in these different diseases. What's the actual like cellular pathway, the like molecular pathway, and what is sort of like mTOR doing, and what happens when you turn down mTOR? So they're all using rapamycin just as a convenient tool to turn down mTOR, so they can see what role mTOR is playing in all these different age-related diseases. And basically, almost all the diseases they're looking at, mTOR is in the middle of the disease. And basically, one of the sort of like top research scientists said, you pick any age-related disease and you like scratch it in the middle of it, you'll find mTOR. You'll find like mTOR in the middle of that disease, driving that disease, lowering mTOR is like stopping the disease. And that was sort of like going on with like things you wouldn't even think of like that. Like, I mean, like things like osteoarthritis. I mean, I was like, thought like, you know, my impression is like a wear and tear kind of like thing. And it turned out they were showing it wasn't a wear and tear kind of thing. It was an inflammatory kind of thing. And if they turned down like mTOR, they would very much improving the disease because they were increasing autophagy. So the cartilage cells were surviving a lot better. And they were decreasing the inflammation that was like destroying the hyaline cartilage. So it's like even like a thing like that. It's like amazing that a disease like that was a real an mTOR disease. So the same thing.
Yeah.
And then it was like, basically, it was like one disease after the other.
The degenerative changes. I'm a radiologist by training, so I was looking at all the degenerative changes over the spine and everything, and we were taught that that's just age related degeneration, wear and tear, like you say. But the evidence now is that no, this is a specific inflammatory process. Right. Yeah,
the amazing thing regarding the spine is when they came up and showing that the spine was a senescent cell disease. There was senescent cells that was damaging the cartilage. By reducing senescent cells in their sort of like animal model, they were sort of like, reducing the disc disease that was like, it seems like, in other words, it seemed like, I mean, my understanding is like, well, the disc is just dries out and then it like breaks down. I mean, the idea that it was like an inflammatory senescent cells were actually sort of like dissolving the disc as an active sort of like process. It wasn't just, these things weren't just wearing out. They were being destroyed by either. And then that's the other thing that was extraordinary. You had this whole like list of like 20 diseases that had been come together by being prevented, like ameliorated with blowing mTOR with that mice. Then you had the senescent cell people, and they come up with like a totally different approach. They're like, if not, they never ever even mention mTOR in their studies. They never talk about mTOR. They just like looking for senescent cells, and they develop all sorts of like, they either use the isotretinoin quercetin in half the studies, or half the studies they just come up with like their own sort of like thing to destroy a senescent cell in that area. And they're coming up with like the same sort of like a whole very long list of diseases that are being stopped if you remove senescent cells. And you look at this list, and it's like, it's the same list. all diseases on one disease. If the disease was on one and it was on the other, it's like no one had checked it yet. But they were basically all on the same list. But the only sort of like big disease that wasn't on that list was Alzheimer's disease. Alzheimer's disease, because like in Alzheimer's disease, they were able to show in 2010, some like great researchers at sort of like University of San Antonio, the Borshop Institute, so like one of the world's great research places, they showed that they could like two different groups, they could prevent Alzheimer's disease and like mouse models of Alzheimer's disease in 2010. And they were continuously showing, perfecting that, different groups, different sort of like models, everything else coming along. But so that was like the only disease that was like, okay, Alzheimer's disease is mTOR, it's not senescent cells. That idea was totally exploded in 2018 when they showed that the major cells driving Alzheimer's disease with senescent cells. It was like that they showed like Moussi from San Antonio. He was just like one of the people, the first name on the state paper. They showed that the cells that everybody had been wondering about since 2006, the neurons with the neurofibrillary tangles, that no one knew what they were sort of like doing, because on one hand, they had neurofibrillary tangles. On the other hand, they kept on surviving and they weren't like dying. He showed that they were senescent cells, and if you remove those senescent cells with the isotretinoin, you stop the disease process. So that was absolutely extraordinary. That was 2018. And now San Antonio is doing an actual study with the isotretinoin and actually treating patients with the same sort of like, the isotretinoin routine. But that was just the start of it. That was just the neurons. And the same sort of like between 2018, 2019, they showed that the oligodendroglia making myelin, they were senescent. They became senescent cells. And the microglia was senescent, and the astrocytes were senescent. The whole group of all the sort of like, all the players, the whole gang of like the three different types of glial cells and plus the neuron with the neurofibrillary tangles were all senescent cells.
Wow. Well, before we get into the senescent cells, and I'm really wondering, that's very exciting. Just before we leave, or before we transition from metformin, and for our audience, we will link to all these important fundamental articles in the show notes, so everyone will have access to them. On rapamycin, you mentioned complex one. Could you talk just briefly about complex one versus complex two, and why we don't do continuous dosing of rapamycin?
I'm not talking about mTOR1 or mTOR2. I was talking about complex one of the mitochondria.
Far
as complex one of the mitochondria, that's as far as I can go with it. I don't understand what's going on with it. I should have like 1, 2, and 3, and 4. But that's very, very complex. And that's sort of like the work I would say, like Baja from like Spain, who like showed that. But as far as like rapamycin has mTOR1 and mTOR2.
Yeah.
And that's the sort of tricky thing. It turned out when they introduced rapamycin in 1999 in transplant medicine, they had no idea about anything from anything. All they knew was that rapamycin was like, you could give an animal rapamycin, it altered the effect of the lymphocytes. They didn't recognize a foreign organ, they didn't recognize a foreign kidney. You could give it and you could use it for transplant medicine. It was safer and better than the medicines they had for transplant medicine. And it had some side effects, but not a particularly sort of like serious side effects. But what they knew is that you had to give it every day. That was the one thing that they knew, that you gave it every day and you maintain a continuous high blood level, because the half-life of rapamycin is about 65 hours. Mm-hmm. So if you give it every day, you're just building up the sort of like blood level, and you have a continuous high blood level. And with the continuous high blood level, that worked. And I don't know whether they knew why that worked, but it turned out that other sort of like researchers and cancer researchers figured out what was going on. And another sort of like one of the top researchers in 2013, I forgot his name right now, he like said, all the benefits in anti-aging are for reducing mTOR1. And all the harmful side effects were for reducing mTOR2. So if you just sort of like use it to sort of like reduce mTOR1, and not reduce mTOR2, that's all you have to do. And that's sort of like, so that was the sort of like key, that was the sort of like, it was like, you know, Lamming, so Dudley Lamming. So he's the one who came up with that idea in 2013. So that was the key thing. The key thing was to realize that the side effects are from mTOR2 and benefits, the anti-aging benefits with the mTOR1. And they're both sort of like, they both are very, very different like compounds, but you can see they're on the same platform. It's like mm-hmm. the same, like they're like related that way, but they're like not related as far as the function very much. The function is like quite different. And it turned out that mTOR2 was 1,000 times more resistant to rapamycin than mTOR1. So when you just take a single dose of rapamycin, you reduce mTOR1, because mTOR1 was set up in the body to respond to everything, like food, this and that, because it was controlling everything. It was responding, so mTOR1 was responding to everything. mTOR2 wasn't responding to anything. mTOR2 was just maintaining like a level of function of all these different things. So you never wanted to decrease mTOR2. In transplant medicine, they introduced rapamycin to be a biologic poison. In other words, they weren't introducing it to do anything good for anybody. They were introducing it to poison the acquired immune system, to alter the function of the lymphocytes so that they could put it in a foreign kidney and the body would not react to it, which is a pretty deranged like immune system to not react to a foreign kidney. But so that was, and, but why it turned out with like they gave it every day is it was a case of if mTOR2 is already formed, the pieces are put together real nice and tight. Rapamycin can't jump into little spots. It can't like mess with them. But when the body has to replace mTOR2 continuously, and that'd be whether you're taking rapamycin or not. So it has to make more mTOR2. In order to make mTOR2, it has to build the little parts and stick all the little parts together. And it can't stick the little parts together at a high blood level of rapamycin because rapamycin competes with some of the spots where the things go. So you can't assemble a functional level of mTOR2 in the presence of a continuous high blood level of rapamycin. So when they use it, they have like a level, you know, a continuous high straight level of blood level of rapamycin, and they check continuously. They do blood levels to make sure that the nadir or low level doesn't get below a certain low level. So they're keeping it at a high level, and that high level they're keeping at, that prevents your body from making a functional amount of mTOR2. You don't have a functional amount of mTOR2, works great for transplant medicine, but it does have sort of some significant sort of like side effects. And of course, it's like, you know, it's not good for insulin resistance, it's having an adverse effect there, it's having an adverse, a lot of adverse effects. And but the bottom line was those people received no benefit. In other words, they did not have any increased lifespan. Whatever benefit they had from decreasing mTOR1 was overshadowed by decreasing mTOR2. They had the kidney transplant, but they did not get any sort of like beneficial side effects. So that was how it worked with that. But the problem for rapamycin is rapamycin got typecast as like a bad guy, is that a million people have used rapamycin in transplant medicine. They've all taken it every day. They have all the side effects or show rapamycin taken every day is not good for you. And you look it up in the PDR, you'll have all sorts of side effects. This says rapamycin is like not good for you when you take it every day because it's all the side effects of reducing mTOR2. So based on that, it's very difficult for other people to use it because there's all these side effects, and because rapamycin is a generic drug, it's called Cerevis, no one's selling a few $100 million to do clinical studies to show that, like, you know, and they have to start off with like stage one, class one clinical studies, just showing a safe way to use it, just saying using it once a week is safe, and that's like before they can even do anything else. So it's like, and people doing studies with it, you can't have it. If you want to have an FDA-approved study or like a study that you're listing with clinicaltrials.gov, you can't use it once a week because it's not approved once a week. You'd have to use it every day. But the problem is it doesn't work every day. So they're like stuck because they can't just say, we're going to use it once a week. And it's like, well, it's not approved once a week. You have to prove it, show it's safe to once a week. Well, I mean, the idea that, well, if it's safe to give every day, it must be safe to use once a week. Like, no, that's not true. You could be using a higher dose once a week. You're like, no, you have to, you mean, in other words, in medicine, you would have, you want to use it different than when it's approved, you have to show that that's a safe way to use it. I mean, if you're doing a clinical trial, you want to have approved by the FDA, you want to have, like, list your trials with clinical stuff. You want to have sort of like the institutional review board sort of like if you are okay. They're going to say, well, Leslie can't do that. Look at all these side effects. We're not approving a clinical trial.
Yeah, it's sort of a catch-22. Well, so
they catch-22. And now they're sort of like some of the clinical physicians, they look at it and say, well, we see all these great like effects in like mice. Show us a human trial. Well, okay, like we don't work on like mice studies. Show us a good human study, and then we'll, you know, that'll be good. They'll like to see that. Well, then, so yeah, but as you said, no one's doing a human study. No one's paying for it. No one's paying for a human study. So it's like it's very difficult for people to like, you know, use it. if they have it, don't have a huge amount of experience using it. Although a few people now are starting to use it at different places, I've heard. A lot of different people are using it.
Well, you have arguably the world's largest experience of clinical use for longevity. I think you mentioned you've just had over 700 patients now on rapamycin that in your in your practice.
And I've been on it for almost like 5 years. I've been on it for like since like January 2016.
And specifically, we in your practice, the use is to pulse the dose activate mTOR, to affect mTOR1, but not affect mTOR2. And that's the whole purpose of that. And
that's the whole purpose. I always use it just like no more frequent than once a week. Mm-hmm. Because once a week is 2.5 half-lives. There's like 65 hours. So if you're taking a sort of like fairly low dose, like 6 milligrams once a week, by 2.5 half-lives, the end of the week, you're at a low enough level that's not going to interfere with mTOR2. But as far as like the other sort of like dose, I've been experimenting with, and this was suggested by Blagoscalone suggested 20 milligrams. And his idea of 20 milligrams was that was the dose they used in cancer medicine. And like that was a well-tolerated dose. And he was concerned that it might not be crossing the blood-brain barrier enough. And he wanted to have more crossing of the blood-brain barrier. He suggested a higher dose. And to have a higher dose, so like that's what I'm doing now. Now I'm just actually using it. So I've been using it for about 3 years at 6 milligrams once a week. And then I had a couple of my patients, they were using it at 10 milligrams and they had a very good response. They just on their own, they sort of like, and they said, no, this is working great. So and I told them, well, I would try that. So I had like a higher dose. I went up to 10 and I sort of like felt that response at that dose. So I stayed at that dose for like a year or so. And then for the last like 4 weeks, I've like tried 20 milligrams every other week. Like the idea of 20 milligrams is seems like a maximum dose, but 2 weeks is 5 half-lives. 5 half-lives is the theoretical like zero. Like whatever dose you start off with, by the time 5 half-lives later, you should be at zero. So if you took 20 milligrams and you waited 2 weeks, you should be at zero by your new dose. So that should sort of like work out.
Yeah, it's just an N of one, but what have you noticed in going from 6 to 10 to 20, if anything, in your personal experience?
10 was better, and like 20 seemed better.
20 better in what way? Like what sort of, what biomarkers, or what did you feel?
I lost a few extra pounds on sort of like 10, and I sort of like felt better, and I sort of like definitely like, I like noticed it sort of like, it's sort of like, it's very subtle. But if you sort of like, I could sort of like notice that, yeah, this seems sort of like a better dose. I mean, it's just like, it has a lot of side effects, but you can sort of like notice the effects when you sort of, what's going on. So it seemed to me that, I like that dose better. I like 20 milligrams every 2 weeks better.
For your patients, what are the
My patients now, I haven't tried that. I'm still on sort of like once a week. So I haven't like on that. I'm still at once a week. And that's sort of like the experimental sort of like stuff. I'm following Blagoscalone's Glory's suggestion on that. But I'm still like most of my patients is still on like once a week. And mostly it's once a week. It's 6 milligrams unless there's a very dramatic problems. But as far as rapamycin, rapamycin is remarkable for like also losing weight. It's like the world's greatest weight loss drug. The number one thing I sort of like measure with everybody is everybody's HOMA-IR score. What that stands for is homeostatic model of insulin resistance. So that's the sort of like insulin resistance, insulin sensitivity. That's the most important thing and being real healthy. And to measure, to get to measure that, you have to measure insulin, and then you measure fasting insulin and fasting glucose, and you multiply the two together. And that gives you your insulin resistance score. Because the insulin is controlling the glucose. So the critical thing is, well, how much insulin do you need to control to get this level of glucose? And so you want to know what the insulin is. So you just multiply them together. And then after you multiply them together, you divide by 405, which is the magic number. And then you do that, one is healthy. You don't want to come up with that number. So one is healthy, and two is early insulin resistance, and three is significant insulin resistance. But if you don't want to do that, you know, there's a very nice website that says home IR score, and you just plug in glucose, plug in insulin, and push calculate, and it comes all right up with your home IR score. So that's something that every single doctor should always use. They should always measure your insulin and glucose and calculate your home IR score.
Absolutely. Fasting insulin is such a powerful marker. Why wait until your glucose becomes elevated? The fasting insulin can be elevated for 10 years before the glucose.
Well, yeah, right. And the idea is that the hemoglobin A1C, that's your average blood sugar. But that only shows when your blood sugar is failing. Like if you have a high level of insulin, and you're controlling the blood sugar, you could have a perfectly good hemoglobin A1C, but you have insulin resistance, and your hemoglobin A1C is not up until you're basically, now you're failing to control your blood sugar. Now it's going up. But so it's a late marker, but the hemoglobin A1C, the home IR score, you can calculate that on everybody. And it's just extraordinarily effective. I mean, like very, very people in fantastic shape. They're like under one, and healthy people are around one. And you know, people with a little bit overweight or two, and people fairly significant overweight tend to get into around three. So it's like, it's a very, very good number that responds very, very well.
Yeah. Yeah, that of your patients that are on the 6 or the 10 dose, what are the most things they report, both positive findings or side effects that you've seen in your practice?
Well, a typical report is, and this is some middle-aged 55-year-old like women physician, and she said the cycling speed went from 15 miles an hour to 18 miles an hour. That's sort of like a good response. People sort of like notice that if they're like at max performing, at maximum cardiac output. So like cyclists notice that, because cyclists are always at maximum cardiac output at some time in their wake up, either like when they're cruising along, or like when they're going up hills, or when they're just sort of like riding flat out as fast as they can go. Cyclists know exactly how they're doing. They like, you know, they know exactly what's going on. And if they have better cardiac function, they know it. And so cyclists are like, is that cyclists notice that they have better cardiac function. And other people sort of like notice that if they are at a real sort of like a strenuous activity. In other words, if they sort of like do something that's like really, really challenging and that they couldn't usually do, and they notice they're not sort of like getting short of breath, they're able to do that better, or like so forth, to do something like, you know, going on a big hike or doing other stuff. But if you're not sort of like doing very much, if you're not challenging yourself, you don't notice much of a change. If you're not doing anything that requires your like maximum cardiac output, you know, like doing things that make you real short of breath, so you can like, you know, but different people might have different things. I mean, if it might just be walking up a steep hill, and I suppose to sort of like, you know, jogging at sort of like tops, like, you know, so forth. But if you like, it tends to improve a thing called age-associated cardiomyopathy. That, now that's the sort of like thing cardiologists never talk about, but that's the number one thing that like all the animals die from, right? Basically, that's the universal thing in the animal world. I mean, they either get cancer or they get age-associated cardiomyopathy. And so it's like a decrease in cardiac function with age. And that was the thing that like Matt Cable was studying in his dog study in Seattle. And he was showing that when they had like the middle-aged dogs and they gave them rapamycin, they improved their cardiac function. And he was showing that on echocardiograms. And then another guy called like Day and Lubinowitz, they were like in the same sort of like place in like, you know, Seattle. They were showing, they were doing the same studies on mice. And they showed a dramatic improvement in the mice in the heart. Interestingly, they showed the same effect on either 40% caloric restriction or rapamycin. And on those sort of like studies, they showed the same kind of like, you know, like improved cardiac function. But those guys went even further and they did a complete proteome. Then they would say like printed out all the like all the proteins like in the heart muscle. And like found like 700. And then they could see which ones went up and which ones went down and which ones changed and which changed with aging and which changed with rapamycin. And they could see that they were having reversal, but basically it was reversal of the mitochondrial function, of the sort of like energy burning function.
And so
it was the energy burning function. It was a shift from all that old hearts were burning glucose and young hearts were burning fat. And they could sort of like, so it was a shift in basically like the substrate that you were using, like they were using a better fuel. It's like young hearts use burn fats. And that's sort of like, and it's like with deterioration, they're like shifting of the substrate. That's what sort of like they were like showing when they actually like traced it down to what was going on. But they were both showing like a marked improvement of cardiac function with sort of like rapamycin. And that's what I say to my patients, the sort of like improvement of heart function. And that they have like, they basically have an improvement of their age-related decline. In other words, they're not going like, if they were like 25, it would have been a benefit. But when they're 50, they're getting back some of what they've lost in like aging. That's sort of like what they're doing. That's one thing people notice. And the other thing people notice is they notice a lot less inflammation, like aches and pains and sort of like joint pains and things like that. And people who are having like some like degrees of mental fogginess, they notice that they're doing better mentally, more mental clarity, right? They like feel that they're improving, like better mental function. That's just sort of like the type of things people like notice. People don't notice that they didn't get any bad diseases. You don't notice that.
Right. Like,
you don't notice that I didn't have a heart attack last week. So, no one notices that. But people notice over like a couple of years that nothing bad happened to them and they're feeling pretty much the same. In other words, they're like, that's the typical response. I'm feeling the same. They didn't get any better, they didn't get any worse, they didn't get any older, they didn't get any diseases. They're like feeling the same.
And
like feeling the same for like 3 or 4 years is like good.
That's a good thing, yeah. What about untoward effects, side effects, aphthous ulcers? What do you see in your patients?
Aphthous ulcers are sort of like tend to be real mild. They're much more sort of like serious in the transplant patients because transplant patients can never stop. But if people usually never get them after they're taking the drug for sort of like 6 months. But in the first couple of months, or if they increase the dose, they're likely to get them. But they tend to be very, very small, like hardly like just like, it's not as much of a problem as something that you notice. It's like a pinpoint little area that you can tell, or you can like barely feel there's some little thing in your mouth that you can like feel. It's unlikely to get to this, like, you know what I mean, the size of an actual sort of like thing you can see or a real sort of sore. But some people get that, but it's usually not a problem because if it's sort of like you can simply stop taking rapamycin, it like heals in a couple of days or a week. So it like heals real fast when you stop taking rapamycin. So it's usually, there's not much of a problem. And it's usually, mostly people can take things. So there's a thing called ulcer swish, which is like a steroid and a couple of other things that like when they can heal better. But that's usually not much of a problem. It's much more of a problem with for the transplant patients, because they can't, they're on a higher continuous dose, so they can't stop and they can't let it heal. But still, it is unclear what it is. I think it's an mTOR1 effect. In other words, I think that the sort of like the mTOR1, I think that it's basically been a disease of unknown cause. But I think what's happening is that the mTOR1 is stopping the proliferation of the cells. If it slows down the proliferation of some group of like mucosal cells, then you'll have a little spot where they didn't sort of like patch it, like repair that. I think that's what's going on. But I think over the fact that it just happens in the beginning and over sort of time, I think the stem cells doing that then get a better function. So I think, but I think it's an impaired stem cell function, and I think it's an mTOR1 function. I think the mTOR1 initially is slowing down the function of the stem cells, but then it's sort of like after it's going on for a period of time to take it, now you have a better function of the stem cells because now you're not getting the problem because it's just happening early. But it's still, but it's much more of a trivial kind of thing. So the main sort of like serious problem is that it decreases, is that a direct effect of mTOR1. It decreases your innate immune system. Now your innate immune system, that's decreasing chronic inflammation. That's generally good for most age-related things, but it's not good if you have a bacterial infection. The innate immune system is your number one defense against bacterial infections. So when you're taking that, your resistance to bacterial infections is definitely decreased. I mean, I saw like one study in which they had mice on caloric restriction, and then they exposed them to say like a burn. Now they were much more likely to die because they were like the caloric restriction is depressing their innate immune system. So that would probably be a problem if it wasn't for the fact that we have like a new miracle drug called antibiotics. So it turns out that like with rapamycin and antibiotics, you're a lot better off fighting a bacterial infection than no rapamycin and no antibiotics. So as long as people have antibiotics on hand, or access to antibiotics, anything that's suspicious for bacterial infection, if you take antibiotics, it clears up within a couple of hours. It just sort of like immediately clears up. So it's, but if you did not have, if you sort of like were taking rapamycin and you didn't take antibiotics and you had a cough, and you didn't take it, and you kept on going, and you just figured, well, I've had coughs before, they get better, you could wind up in the hospital with pneumonia. So it's real important to figure that you're on rapamycin, your innate immune system fighting a bacterial infection is decreased, and if you have anything like a cough that could be a bacterial infection, you should take an antibiotic like zithromycin. And then whatever you have, cause a bacterial infection, it'll clear up very, very fast. So I would say that's the main sort of like thing. As far as the other type of side effects, is there's a transient increase in lipids. But that's not sort of like, that's not a dangerous effect. Because with usually if your LDL and so forth went up, it would seem like you had an increased risk. But with rapamycin, you're not at an increased risk because you're decreasing the lipids are leaving the tissue as opposed to entering the tissues. It's decreasing their ability to enter. It's decreasing their like ability to be oxidized, and it's decreasing inflammation. So they did various like studies with like coronary artery disease or atherosclerosis. It didn't matter that they had like the animals could have real high cholesterol levels. The cholesterol is still leaving the tissues, and the lesions were clearing up. So the lesions were clearing up regardless of what the blood level was. So if like rapamycin, the blood level, that would be dangerous if you weren't on rapamycin, is much less dangerous if you're taking rapamycin. But if you can always sort of like just add a statin to it, if it's sort of like, if it's like elevated, and it's usually that effect tends to be transient. But so I would say that's not too much of a problem. And generally, for the most part, it has the effect on insulin to like lower insulin. And the idea is like to balance that off, you're supposed to like lower insulin and improve your insulin sensitivity and like lose weight. If you simply lower insulin and you didn't do anything to your insulin sensitivity, glucose could go up a little bit. But for the most part, it's having people, the net effect for most people is improving their insulin sensitivity because they're like, their insulin is going down and their insulin resistance is going down. And so it's having, you want to have those two effects, lower insulin, improve insulin sensitivity. But yeah. Most, so then you want to have that. But I would say it's an extraordinarily good drug for preventing diabetes because type 2 diabetes, because it's a very good drug for losing weight. People like can lose, like on rapamycin, people can lose, like, you know, the extra weight and become insulin sensitive and totally reverse insulin resistance and like type 2 diabetes.
Yeah, this is a fascinating experience you have. If it's all right with you, this has been so useful and so fascinating. I'd love to invite you. I'd love to take the dasatinib discussion and the senolytics. And if it's all right with you, I'd like to invite you back again to spend a whole segment on senolytics, if that's okay.
Sure. Yeah, that'd be great.
And this time, before we go today, just you already mentioned your current regimen of rapamycin, and then we'll talk about the senolytics, I guess, next time. Can you share with us any of your choices about diet, any particular fasting that you do, or any exercise or other lifestyle things that you do?
Well, as far as like exercise, I like suggest people like at an hour of walking 3 or 4 times a week. I think that's sort of like very, very important. As far as the number one thing I think people should do is they need like a tape measure and measure the waistline. And if you're 5'10" and 70 inches tall, your waistline should not be over half your height. Your waistline should be 35 inches. So I think that's the only sort of like diagnostic test you need is a tape measure. As far as the diet, I don't do any fast. I think fasting is good because it lowers like mTOR. But as far as like a diet, the diet that I like to try to be on that I'd recommend is a low methionine diet. It turns out that like methionine is a very strange amino acid. It's codon 1. For every protein made by every sort of everything that has a nucleus, it's every time they make a protein, position number 1 is methionine. So if your body is low in methionine, it thinks, well, we better not be like, it's the same as caloric restriction. Well, we better like be turning things down. We don't have any methionine. And methionine is, a low methionine diet is pretty much a vegan diet. It's like, in other words, methionine is high in like fish and chicken and like beef and eggs, but it's low in most vegetables. So if you're eating like a basically vegan diet, you're eating a low methionine diet. That's sort of like very similar to a caloric restriction diet.
I see. Oh, that's great. Yeah.
Yeah. They did a study on sort of like rats. They had rats living 40% longer on just a low methionine diet. So that's the sort of thing I like about the diet. And also I like a diet that's sort of like low in what Helen Flessaro called advanced glycation end products. They're the things you sort of like get when you like cook meats at a high temperature. And like grilling and frying and so forth. They're the things that make that foods taste great.
That's right. It's a balance, right? Yeah. Well, that That's great. Thank you. Thank you so much, Alan, for spending time with us. And I'm really looking forward to our next session when we talk about Senolytics and the great work you're doing there. But I just want to thank you for your time today and sharing the beautiful things you're doing with your patients.
One other thing I sort of like noticed that squeezed in about Senolytics. San Antonio, Texas is now treating people with early Alzheimer's disease and like MCI. Senolytics to stop them, and I expect, based on this sort of like the study they mentioned, I expect them to get very, very good results in that. And the sooner people start the treatment, the better.
Great, great. All right. Well, thank you again for taking the time to be on the program, and I look forward to speaking with you again soon.
If I put in one last thing,
sure,
I should go to 23andMe and get genetic testing done.
What SNPs in particular to look for?
Everyone will need to know if they have a gene for APOE4. 20% of the people are E4 positive. They're 50% of the cases of Alzheimer's disease. They're 3 times more likely. They're 5 or 10 years to your onset. That's the people who sort of like are at risk. People have to know they're at risk so they can take proactive steps to prevent it, because it's very preventable if you know you're at risk.
Great. I love that. And we'll link to 23andMe, and also we'll put the links to the SNPs in there. So if people want to do their own searches on after they download their data, we'll show them how to do that as well.
Okay, great. Very good. Well,
thanks again, Alan. It was great talking with you.
All right, okay, bye.
No, this is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified health provider with any questions you may have. Never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking of it because of something you've seen here. If you find this to be of value of you, please hit that like button and subscribe to support the work we do on this channel. Also, we take your suggestions and advice very seriously. Please let us know what you'd like to see on this channel. Thanks for watching, and we'll hope to see you next time.